Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. Sunil Yapa's book, Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, was the Center County Reads book for 2018 and a finalist for the 2017 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Yapa is a State College native who graduated from Penn State in 2002 with a degree in economic geography. He got his MFA at Hunter College. I talked with him in front of an audience on the Penn State University Park campus.
Can I just start by saying, I can't even express to you guys like what a deep, deep honor it is that I was asked to come back and that this book was chosen for the Center Community Reads. I made a joke on Facebook that if I had known, I would have cursed less than the book. But is that, you know, that's true in a lot of ways. When I started writing the book in 2009, I never, ever, ever thought that there would be this many people reading it, even if it would get published.
Well, first off, your book, set during the World Trade Organization protests in 1999, 60,000 protesters showing up in Seattle to stop trade negotiations. The book follows two protesters, two cops, the chief of police, his son, and a WTO delegate.
Did everyone get that?
Sri Lanka. So seven different people.
Seven characters.
You were a student at Penn State. Why did you choose to set this book so far away? 20 years later, you decided you were going to set this somewhere across the country and 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. There's two questions there. Well, one is, as a fiction writer, I don't really believe in the surface, that the surface details define us. So just as an example, I don't think that I need to write biracial Sri Lankan character. Every single character needs to fit my sociological census characteristics. 40-year-old, middle-class, biracial Sri Lankan man. So what is important is my emotional truth, you know? So people often ask me who am I in this book, and we can talk about that, but really my emotional truth is in all those characters. So I think the same is true for the setting, right, and for the event. So I wasn't at the event. I was here in school at Penn State, but I really grew up in a house where I was very aware of these kind of issues. My dad, who's here, hates it when I say this, but he's a Marxist geographer. He claims post-Marxist, post-structural. I'm not an academic. I don't know what all that means, but I do know we had upstairs the socialist version of Monopoly. That was in the attic. It's called class struggle. Like, and it has what, Karl Marx arm wrestling with Henry Ford or something?
Nelson Rockefeller.
And so there you go. So I grew up with it. You know, it's a fascinating thing and maybe a lesson to some of the younger writers in the room. When I started writing, I thought that I had to write about what you know, about my own experience. And so I was writing about biracial young men, the Sri Lankan father and an American mother, or my dad complained that the father was often off dead in those stories. But again, it's not the details, right? And it was like what I thought I was supposed to write about, like what I thought would be published in the New Yorker. And that's fine, but it wasn't until I got to grad school, and frankly, it wasn't until I discovered this subject, which had been very important to me in my personal life, but I hadn't yet realized that your personal life and your writing life should be one and the same, right? I hadn't realized that to write a good novel, you have to deeply care about it. It's not just, oh, what's a good idea? What's gonna be made into a movie? Or like, you know, I'll do a speculative fiction, dystopic, blah, blah, blah. It has to be something that really comes out of your emotional core, that you care
about. Was there something about the World Trade?
Right, good question.
So,
I grew up with all these issues, and to be honest, I didn't go to the protest. I had been arrested in my hometown, as I often say. I got arrested here in Lederer Park, some of you might know it, for smoking pot, of all things, when I was 17, so it's not on my record. But I didn't want to go to jail. So essentially, I was a coward. I knew one of the strategies at the protest was going to be mass arrest, and I didn't want to spend the night in jail. I'd already done it, and as a man of color, it wasn't something I wanted to repeat. After that, during my research, I actually learned that people were trained to go into jail, so it was actually like a pretty empowering experience. My best friend while I was writing this, who I lived with, is a writer and an activist, and he said he actually had a love affair while he was in jail, so it was like a really positive experience for him when he got arrested in Seattle. But I cared so much about this subject, but I was a coward, I didn't go. And in some ways, I'll say another thing. I don't live by my values, even today. And back then, for sure. So I have a lot of values, let's say environmental values, social values, that I don't even come close to living to. And when I saw the Seattle protests erupt, for me it was an eruption of all those values, all those emotions I had that I didn't know whether people were feeling, and I didn't know 60,000 people were feeling, and frankly, I didn't know people were willing to go into the streets and get tear gassed and pepper sprayed because of those feelings. And so when I was doing my research, I saw a photo early on of a woman, a white woman, on her knees in an intersection. She's bleeding, she's been hit in the head, and someone, I assume a stranger, is tending to the wound. And I thought, what in the world would make this woman go out in the street and risk bodily harm? Not to expand her own rights. She's not fighting for herself. She's fighting for someone maybe who makes shoes in Sri Lanka or Vietnam, or, you know, fighting for the rights of someone who's other, someone she probably will never meet. And I thought, that's when it really all clicked for me. And I thought, this is an amazing moment. This woman has so much courage that I didn't have. Courage to fight for the other and put her body on the line for the other. And I was also, be frank, pretty confused about that. I was like, why would you do that? And I think that it's good to be confused about the subject you're gonna spend 6 years writing a novel about. So in a way, it's a working out of my own questions, if you will. This is why I don't like the term protest novel. It implies that I have an answer and I'm gonna shove it down your throat, or and that's not at all what my project is. I'm trying to ask questions. Shove those down your throat.
Well, and the protesters in this novel are kind of a mixed bag. I wondered if you'd read us a section from when the protesters first show up. This is Victor, the police chief's son. He's gone to sell drugs to the protesters, and he's describing them for the first time as he sees them for the first time.
Yeah, let me fill you in a little bit, just a tiny bit, for the aspiring novelist in the audience. A great trick is, so Victor is the main character, I think. He's 19 years old. He's kind of been wandering the world trying to figure it out, and he's back in Seattle trying to sell weed to the protesters. And it's a great technique for a novelist is kind of make a likable character, give them a terrible idea, and then send them on their way and watch them fail. All right, so this is Victor. But also, you know, he's our window into the protest from someone who's not political yet, maybe, who's there for different reasons, so he has a kind of a different view of them. Here they came, stomping into the dawn from their suburban warrens, from their gorgeous mansions that glittered fat on the sound. Civil rights lawyers wearing combat boots, radical teachers in sheepskin-lined jackets. He saw them come rising into the morning air, a chant on their lips. What do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now. What did that mean, justice? He looked at a blonde girl in overalls, an African-type shawl looped atop her head. He looked at her angry blue eyes, her perfect white teeth, her gym-sculpted arm naked to the cold, and he didn't know what justice meant to her, to him, to anybody in this country. He saw them come rising from North Face tents gone swampy with sex, from the paint-splattered warehouse where they gathered to gossip and train, from the cellar of the church where they had sat in fold-out chairs discussing what they knew of what they called the third world, and there was a look on their faces, all their sweet, round, high-fructose faces, that was hoping everything was more or less okay with the world, even though they knew it wasn't. And Victor, looking at that look, he didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
So these protesters, they're not like Victor. They're mostly white. Victor, as you said, half black, half white. Get a little bit of racial commentary from Victor when he says, He finds out the protesters have actually negotiated with the cops for a mass arrest. And he says, "You met with the cops? Wow, it must be nice to be white."
Oh, does he say that?
Yeah, he says that.
Well, as someone smarter than me once said, your character should be smarter than you. So.
It feels pertinent. Like it talks to the moment now.
I mean, it's unavoidable. I'm joking, but it's unavoidable to look at protests and not understand that people of color have a different relationship with the police than white folks do. I think that's undeniable, for me at least. And it was certainly something I encountered when I did read a lot of. So I did a lot of research for this book. Do you want me to talk about that?
Sure. Actually, that's next on my list. I mean, we've got the pepper spray, the rubber bullets, police violence. A scene where the police actually put a Q-tip into the woman's eye with pepper spray on it, which I thought was particularly brutal.
Yeah, but true.
Yeah, so.
That scene in particular is actually true. Although it didn't happen in Seattle, it happened a few years earlier during protests about the redwoods, to protect the redwood trees. So it was very important to me to try to tell a true story and to not, certainly not to glorify the violence, but if I can use this phrase, to bear witness to the violence. If I was going to write this book, I needed to tell the true story, or to, as true as I could. I realized very quickly there were a lot of narratives in the popular culture around protests and around this specific protest that were not true. So I thought I need to find real accounts from people. So I went to Seattle, and there's an amazing archive. A professor had put out a call for materials, and they had archived them in the basement of the University of Washington Library. And so there was maybe 30 boxes there with photographs, signs that people had, first-hand stuff. You could almost like smell the tear gas coming off of it. There were VHS tapes in there. There were a ton of first-hand accounts that people wrote and sent in. So that was a gold mine. For a novelist, that's an absolute gold mine. I got really lucky, too. I mentioned before my roommate when I was in New York, who was also in grad school with me. His name was Tennessee Jones, also a writer, very, very good writer. Weirdly, it must have been 6 months into I was working on this project, he said, "Oh, you know, I was at those protests. I mean, we lived together." I said, "Really?" And this is the guy who went to jail and had, met someone. But and he said, "I also have a bunch of zines from back in the day. You guys remember what zines are? So they're blogs before they were blogs. Just a sheet of paper, fold it in half, turn it into a magazine. Activists or anyone would write little political essays, draw cartoons, and he had a shelf of those from the time period. And so that's just such a novelist dream to have this fly on the wall look into what activists were actually saying to each other that they would never say to me, right, if I was interviewing them, right? So that was an incredible resource. It has recipes in it, and like a lot of those little details in the book come from those zines, Mm-hmm. And then the last thing where I got really lucky, I discovered that the city of Seattle had recorded all the police scanner traffic from all 5 days of the protests. And it was on disk in the city hall. And they didn't want to give it to me. They said they'd lost it in the flood. And I said, "How do you lose CDs in a flood?" And they said, "Okay, here it is." And so I got a bunch of CDs of it, and I listened to it. And
that's a thread throughout the book. We hear those scanners.
The scanner traffic, is most of that is real. Some of it, you can't even believe it's real. The flamethrower one, where they're like, one cop is screaming, "She's using a flamethrower with her mouth." And it's clearly like, I don't know how to describe it, but a lot of people were doing acts like that, so it's clearly not a flamethrower with their mouth. But again, seeing how the cops were talking to each other was for me a real moment, because in my original drafts, the cops were a very easy target, a very easy villain. And I discovered that the book and the protests themselves were about empathy. They were about caring about people very different than ourselves and trying to imagine, empathy is more than sympathy. It means trying to imagine yourself in someone's shoes, in their skin. And so I said, I'm gonna have to try to empathize with the cops. And so I put a card above my desk that said, no easy villains. And finding them talking to each other was one of the just gifts, because the first time I heard a cop scared because they were undermanned, first time I heard a cop scared, I thought, ooh, that's human. I can write myself into what that might be like.
What do you want readers to take away from that, you know, about others who seem against them?
I don't know. I mean, again, the book in a lot of ways, I would say, is smarter than I am, because I don't have that much compassion for people who disagree with me, particularly in this age, right? Are you kidding? I don't know. You know, it's something that, like, you do in a novel, because a novel asks us to think more deeply and feel more deeply and be our higher selves. I don't know that I'm that person walking around.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy, and our guest is Sunil Yapa. His book, Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, is set during the World Trade Organization protests of 1999. I talked with him in front of a live audience.
So you said that one of the main characters you relate to the most, I'm guessing this is Victor, who's half black, half white, has trouble fitting in, travels the world trying to find himself. You're half Sri Lankan, half white. How much do you relate to that? And is it about that fitting in, not fitting in, finding a place in the world?
Yeah, it's interesting. Victor on the surface definitely most resembles me at that age. But to be honest, the character I most emotionally relate to is the woman, King. That's me, you know? And in some ways, all of them are me. Like, I started out to write a book that didn't have me in it, and then discovered you had to people a book with a bunch of emotions, and I'm like, well, where am I gonna get those? Oh, from myself, right?
You've lived all over the world, Greece, Guatemala, Chile, Argentina, China, India, London, Montreal, New York City. Mm-hmm. I notice your website does not mention State College. So how did all these places that you've lived inform your worldview as you wrote this book? And how do you feel like you look at the world differently than most Americans?
Oh, you know, you're right that I wrote a lot of the book sitting in my dad's house in Spring Creek. So. Even though I wrote a lot of the book in Guatemala, I didn't really I never looked out the window and then wrote down what I was seeing. But I think, to be honest, I lived in all those countries for financial reasons. I'll tell you the story. I used to sell posters. In fact, I sold posters here at Penn State. I sold posters all over the country. I would work for 2 months, I'd make about $10,000, and I'd take that money and go to another country where I could live most of the year and just write. Now, the irony of taking advantage of the global of the exchange rate and the strength of the dollar to write a book about the global economy, it's not lost on me. That's exactly what I did. It's kind of crazy. But again, I don't think I looked out the window and grabbed details, but it's inevitable that that experience filters in. And if you don't mind, I'll tell you a story. One of the places I lived was Guatemala, and I had a friend at the time from New York City who was a painter. Would move down there, and she was doing kind of a Peace Corps, but it was called the Art Corps, doing art therapy stuff with some really rural villages, some Mayan villages up in the mountains, and I'd go visit her. She'd gotten a puppy. Someone had given her a puppy for her birthday, and so we used to take the dog for walks, and she lived on the outskirts of this really small town, and we'd walk up into the mountains through, I think they were broccoli fields. But through these fields up into the mountains, and one of the first days we came back, and it was starting to get dark, and we sat on the edge of town, and near a little bodega, not even a store, literally a guy's house, and he would sell things out of his window. And so I bought a beer from him out the window and sat and talked to him. And these little kids kept coming up, and each one of them would buy one candle, like a long, you know, long taper candle. And I said, "Why? What's with the candles?" And he said, "No, I lose. There's no electricity." And another time, we're coming back from a walk. It may have been the next time, and it's already dark. And out in the fields, I saw these little ships floating in a sea of darkness. The flickering light of one candle coming through the cracks in a shack made of, you know, salvaged wood and tin. These tiny little one-room shacks. That's in the book. That feeling is in the book. I don't have a quick rush to pity those people, to have some moral judgment about how great my life is and how awful their life is. I have no idea what their life is. And that's actually the thing that hit me the hardest was, I might as well live on the moon for as much as I understand what it's like to live that experience. Now, we could get used to each other's lives. I'm not saying that, that we're fundamentally different, but the material conditions of our lives are so different that we might as well be living on the moon. And I think that feeling's in the book, even if I didn't go home and directly transcribe that.
So it's been 2 years since the book came out. A lot has changed in those 2 years.
A lot hasn't, too, but...
Yeah. The lefty protesters in your book are against these trade agreements. Our U.S. president is now against these trade agreements, some of them for different reasons. When you see that, you know, how do you react? What do you think?
Well, so these protests were called anti-globalization protests. So that, again, that phrase, anti-globalization, is a very easy tag, but it doesn't mean anything. Because no one was anti-globalization. They were anti, let's say, corporate globalization, for instance. So the whole thing about Trump, like on the surface, it seems as though these people were anti-trade and Trump was anti-trade. It's not the same thing. They're not protesting the same thing. They're not talking about the same thing. These people are not anti-globalization. You know, in a lot of ways, they're pro-globalization, but they wanted, built into the so-called free trade agreements, protections for workers, protections for the environment. They wanted to globalize justice, not corporate profit.
I don't want to give away too much, but if I'm interpreting it correctly, the ending of the book is kind of ambiguous.
He lives. I tried to kill him, and my editor said, "No, that's not the book I bought."
Well, I wondered why not that, you know, the happy ending or the devastating ending. He lives. Okay. If anyone else was unclear.
We could talk about that for a second. You know, again, we were talking about whether this is a protest novel or not. And someone said, because as a reader, I'm not angry at the end. It can't be a protest novel. Well, two things. Well, my journey, I was very angry. And about two-thirds of the way through, I got very tired of that anger. It burned me out, as I think it does for a lot of people. It's hard not to feel outraged, but then you start wondering what else is that, what is there beyond the rage? And I went looking for it in the book, and the characters went looking for it. And the thing that I found, I guess, was compassion. What was the first question? I'm sorry.
About the ending.
So thinking about whether it was going to be an up or a down ending or what felt right, or I think it was really important, and this book was being finished in 2015 when when Black Lives Matter, it's not that it has stopped being an issue, but it was really in the headlines, and I was really thinking about it. Everyone was really thinking about police brutality and black lives, and I was writing that very thing, whether I meant to or not, and so I had to, again, bear witness to that. And I didn't want to let anyone off the hook, but I also, to me, the honest ending was a small moment of reconciliation. And then that is, out of this darkness, if we have any way out, and I mean this in real life, if we have any way out, it's through those tiniest moments of human connection.
So this was your first novel. What did you, I'm assuming kind of, you're still kind of writing.
Well, kind of. I wrote, it's kind of the second version of the novel.
The first one was lost, right?
Yeah. So the first one was 604 pages. And I remember that exact number because I finished it in Chile and I didn't back it up. I was living in this little beach house and I didn't have any internet, which is one reason I got so much done. But I didn't back it up. I would just hide my laptop in the oven. It survived all that. Like, I don't do any baking, so it was fine. Totally fine. I came back to the States and was selling posters, and someone broke into my hotel room and stole my backpack, and forget all the other stuff in it. I was like, oh my God, my book. So it was gone. So I had to write it all over again. And frankly, I wasn't going to. I had no desire to. When I came out of the like 6 months of depression, which I have no memory of, I started thinking about the book again. And it wasn't, the book. I was like, oh God, the book. No. And in the end, it was a huge gift. That first book, I think, had about 65 characters in it. There was no main character, you know? It was like what I would call, I had started in grad school, it's what I would call like a clever young grad student kind of book, like postmodern pastiche, which is awesome. I mean, Austerlitz writes those are great books. But I got a chance to ask myself, is that the kind of book that I read? Why do I read? And I love reading books about characters, about people, about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, about people that think they're doing the right thing. I mean, everyone in this book thinks they're doing the right thing, even if they're in total conflict with each other. I love reading about people struggling against, you know, external conflict, but internally. That's the book that I, the second time around that I wrote, it's a very different book.
So what are you working on now?
That's top secret.
Top secret. What have you taken away from Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist into the next book?
I really, I stumbled into the idea of, I guess we would call this a nonfiction novel, which I didn't realize until I was about 2 years into the project. I felt a deep obligation to tell the truth. But so, for example, it's really, really, really important that we know the tear gas went off before any windows were ever broken. And that's the truth. And that's important that that's in the book and that order was correct. On the other hand, there's it's not a nonfiction book, and there's plenty of great nonfiction about that event. It's a novel, so I have all the obligations of the imagination, let's say, and to tell a good story and to not bore my readers. So it's a weird balancing act of those two things, but I got really excited by that. So I think that's the thing I want to take away, is I might try to continue writing quote-unquote nonfiction novels. And the other thing is, maybe, like I said, curse less.
Curse less. Be chosen for more reading programs.
Well, maybe we're conditioned as writers to be ignored, that no one's going to care, no one's going to read it. But I didn't think anyone was ever going to read it. It never occurred to me. It's amazing.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for being here.
Sunil Yapa is the author of the book Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. I talked with him in front of a live audience. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.